Greetings, urban farmers, gardeners, and healthy food visionaries. Farmer Greg here, and welcome to the 832nd episode of the Urban Farm Podcast, where every day we work together to educate and inspire you to become part of your food revolution.
Today on the podcast, we have someone who started a food co-op to change the way we eat. We're talking with Cindy Gentry about food co-ops and how they can change the food landscape. Cindy is a founding member and the current manager for Sun Produce Cooperative in Phoenix, Arizona, which was established in 2017. She brings more than 35 years experience with nonprofit hunger prevention and healthy food systems development. Cindy has worked statewide in Arizona to nurture local food production and distribution and to support local farmers' markets, including spearheading the work to establish the Phoenix Public Market. She helped create the Arizona Farmers Market Nutrition Program and the SNAP Market Project, which allows low-income children, adults, and seniors to access better nutrition by shopping for fresh vegetables at local farmers markets while bringing new income to Arizona producers. Welcome to the show today, Cindy. Are you ready to rock?
I am. I'm glad to be here and talk with you, Greg.
Thank you. And so I shared a bit about you. Can you fill in the blanks for us and share more about the path you took to get where you're at today?
The path has always included food and family and gathering around food to exchange ideas and be creative and have arguments and have all your relatives chiming in at the same time and perhaps not listening to each other. And all of that imprinted on me from an early age to understand that gathering around the table is where you can make things happen. Mm. So you set the table, you bring the food, and then see what you can do to make things better, fun, and bring people together.
Nice. And I just have to say, you and I have known each other for decades.
Yes.
We work together on projects in Phoenix loosely. So I know of your work, but tell me about some of the projects that you created in Phoenix previous to the co-op.
The opportunity to work with farms came early on as I worked with the Association for Arizona Food Banks, which is now the Arizona Food Bank Network. And for 10 years, I got to work with the Statewide Gleaning Project and go out in the fields and meet farmers who had more food than they could sell, and they were either going to turn it over or they didn't have anything to do with it. And so they donated to the food banks. And so we created an opportunity for those donations. And then I began to get to know the farmers and the hard work and the perseverance and the very bad jokes that they told in the early hours. And I started listening to them and thinking about ways that we could support them in what they were already doing and grow that. And in about 1999, the federal government changed the food stamps from paper currency that you could use in a grocery store to electronic benefits. And it occurred to me and a group of friends that people who use food stamps no longer had paper currency to come and shop at farmers markets. And so we began to listen to what was going on around the country and found out that there were card readers that were able to process SNAP benefits. We got a grant from the Department of Health and Human Services to begin with to purchase and implement the operation of 20 of them at farmers markets around the state. And then we're getting to know these markets. They're getting to include more people from the community. There's more money coming to the farms. What else can we do? And I had the privilege of attending conferences around the country and heard about Farmers Market Nutrition Program, which was not functioning in Arizona.
Wow.
And then with the guidance of Ginny Hildebrand, a mentor at the Food Bank Association, I wrote a proposal to Nina Mason Pulliam, who funded a very unique partnership between the Food Bank Network and the Department of Health Services to get the first Arizona Farmers Market Nutrition Program in, and it was to help senior citizens be able to shop at farmers markets using vouchers for fresh local food. And so now we have people of varying economic backgrounds coming to the market to shop. The markets start looking different. You start seeing farmers that kind of look more like some of the customers that are coming. And there's this whole mix of, oh, local food just isn't for the white middle class people. There's all sorts of opportunities for people to come in. So those were two programs that I got to work on with friends, Emma Sarai, some people from the Hunger Advisory Council through DES, through the Food Bank Network, through the farmers. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, you know what? Phoenix needs a public market. Just we're the fifth or sixth largest city in the country, and there are lots of farmers markets started by friends like Dee Logan and Bo Mostow around and in Tucson all over, but there's no public market that acts as a retail and a wholesale terminal, a gathering place with stores and restaurants. And started the chance again with Emma Soroy, who was and is a good friend, and her contacts at Arizona State University, Downtown Phoenix Partnership. We ended up doing a business plan. I went to the partnership and I said, hey, this is a really good idea. And got it that they heard about 42 really good ideas every day. And
right.
Brian Kearney, who was the director then, said, get me a business plan. And I panicked because I'd never done one before. And then finally, it still was a really good idea. And I was like, fine, I'm going to learn how to do a business plan. And I did, with help from the Project for Public Spaces. They have some online guides, and presented it. And then it was like, wow, this could be a thing. Downtown Phoenix was still pretty much of a ghost town in 2002, 2003. Mm-hmm. And we picked a spot. We had a man, Kurt Schneider, that was open to the idea. He had a piece of property. I sat there for days and weeks and just looked at what the traffic flow was. There wasn't very much. And it was right next to where ASU had just started their new campus.
Downtown.
Yeah. But there's nothing much else around yet. And I was like, fine, let's see, do more research. We did a feasibility study with the support of USDA. We had help from a local architecture firm called Moss Studios. And we isolated criteria that would contribute to success. We did everything as professionally as we could and built a team. And in 2005, we launched the Downtown Phoenix Public Market. And the underlying mission always was to increase access to healthy local food and support income for farmers and create a gathering place where it normalized bumping elbows with people you wouldn't normally bump into and enjoying food you would never see in the grocery store. And all the colors, the sounds, the sights, all of that opening up creative energy in your mind. And
back then, downtown Phoenix was still a little blighted, and it wasn't the thriving downtown that it is today.
It was pretty empty. And yeah. My help one day for setting the market up were people who were homeless who stayed in that parking lot. And one day, one of the young men said, hey, literally, do you have anything for me to eat? I'll work and I'll help you. Because I was there pretty much on my own, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And I said, oh, that's a really good idea. And the next thing, he brought friends. And so we went with it. And the landlord, Kurt, was great. The team was great. And we had done outreach, we had done community surveys. We were able to bring a core of people, and it was fun. We had probably six farmers. We brought in crafts, and there was always this conversation, crafts aren't a farmer's market. We didn't have enough yet, and you need to have mass to make a farmer's market work. And so then we started having prepared food vendors come. Some of them are still there. The market has changed its mission. It's moved from its original spot, but some of the original vendors are still there and
Wow.
have grown their business. And that's what, almost 20 years at this point.
Yeah.
And we watched downtown grow up around us. And there was no grocery store downtown. There was a Safeway about, 3 miles away from the market lot. The Fry's hadn't opened up yet downtown. And gosh, we should put a grocery store in. That will bring even more people on when it's not market days. And so we had local food, local wine, local beer. We had a restaurant. We brought in some young chefs that were amazing. We shared our kitchen with some burgeoning entrepreneurs, and there was music. Always there's music. There was people wandering through with their instruments, and then people we actually invited to show up. There's only one disaster one night when a young man came in that I couldn't hit a note if it sat on his shoulder. And one of the vendors told him that the market was closing and he had to go home. And he left. But for the most part, we had a really fun time. And so I thought we had a grocery store. It stayed open for like 4 years, 3 or 4 years. It was another gathering place. So we shared it with Royal Coffee, and they had an amazing clientele that came through. You heard I eavesdropped on a million conversations from
I'm sure.
all kinds of subjects. There was food invented, food created, food sold, and there was always a crowd. It was really good energy.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. And then so fast forward to 2016 or so, and you come up with this idea with a group of people called the Sun Produce Cooperative. What was that? Or what is that?
The Sun Produce Cooperative came out of observations that the small farms that we worked with at the market all had the same issues and challenges, and they all viewed each other as competitors.
Right.
And they imagined almost to a person that there, if there was only $10 in the world and the other guy got $10, they weren't going to get anything. And I'm on the outside of this listening to the feedback and the complaints and the praise and all this. And I was like, okay, you guys, we need to get you together in the same room. So instead of just telling me all this stuff, you can talk to each other. And my friend Kelly Young at the extension sat down. She saw the farmers on a regular basis, and she engineered some nights out where perhaps there were adult beverages if you wanted to partake. And so people would start getting to see each other outside of work and all of this. And one day we were all mostly at a food safety class engineered by the Department of Agriculture and the U of A Extension. And Kelly and I, after the conversation and the class, we said, how many of you all in this room actually own the land that you're farming on? And out of the 36 farms, only two or three did that were there. And we
Wow.
started asking questions like, what are your needs? What we thought food safety, if they got the certification, would help them get into new markets. And so that's a good thing. And we wanted to put together a group that was interested in getting their food safety certification.
Hold on. Food safety, we're talking about safe food to eat.
Yes.
There's also the other side of that coin, it seems like to me, that it's have a safe food system that actually can grow food. That's where you're going, isn't it?
It is that in my life, I do not pretend to know more than anybody. And I know that the farms don't want to hurt anybody. I
Yeah.
know that some of the myths about, I understand more about the use of pesticide and herbicide than I ever did watching corn and soybeans grow and why people do it. But a safe food system, along with normal access by everybody, is the goal. But you will hear a lot about liability. The food safety classes for good agricultural practices often start out with a lot of horror tales about death and lawsuits. And then once you get past that talk, and you understand that, yeah, you should keep your water supply clean. You should keep the javelinas out of the corn. You should pick up glass and rusty things. You should have your water and soil tested. And if there's a problem, you should know how to tell what field your food came from and who picked it and basic hygiene. And so if you can do plans like that, then people's food will be safe. And there's a whole bigger conversation, Greg, I think, about being stewards of the land and where farmers fit in. And I think it'd be good to talk to some farmers because many of the people that I know who do farm, that's their whole identity, that it is connected to the earth so deeply that they can't separate themselves and from it. And if they don't get to farm, what will they do? And so it's an amazing conversation, especially in a place like Phoenix, where all the good farmland is being preserved under blacktop or buildings or faster than we can talk, than we can count. Yeah. We got these people in a room, Kelly and I did. We locked the door, brought in pizza, heard each other tell really bad jokes, and then we got the food safety thing moving along. And after about a year and a half, we said, okay, guys, what do you want to do now? What do we want to play now? And they were like comfortable with each other. And they said, let's form a group. And then we looked into what kind of groups that were out there that had farmers involved in them. And we picked a cooperative. And we happened to have on our advisory committee, a man that works around the country, John Penry, that worked with cooperatives. And so he agreed to help us connect to some ways that cooperatives organize themselves. We finally looked at the bylaws for Fifth Season Co-op, which is out of Viroqua, Wisconsin, and right in the heart of where Organic Valley Farm Co-op is located, but they called the Fifth Season so that they would, when it's winter time and there's nothing to sell, they have grows in Wisconsin. They have preserved and frozen root crops and other crops so that there's always some income coming in for the farms. And they were kind enough to lend us their bylaws. We adopted them, we incorporated them on May 5th, 2017. So we're approaching our 7th year.
Nice.
And we didn't really know that we had anything to offer anybody. So we kept our sights really low. We go around and pick up food from all sorts of different farms around central Arizona after orders have been placed by all sorts of different customers and have understood ourselves now to be more of a food hub, which means we aggregate, we build orders, we distribute, we find ways to connect the farms. And in the middle of that hub are the farms helping say what they need to do and what they want to do and what they don't want to do. And we are working on literally growing some roots for the co-op. We're located at Blue Sky Organic Farms in Litchfield Park. They let us use it. We rent a cooler there. We park our trucks there. And we have two full-time drivers, soon to be three, two part-time drivers. We have a program coordinator slash admin bookkeeper, and I'm the manager. And so we're looking to, and we have a board of directors, we're looking to put down some roots and acknowledge ourselves as growing from $17,500 that first half year of business to more than $1.5 million business this year. And what the future looks like. So we're investigating all that as we speak.
Nice. And I did have an experience before I left Phoenix with Sun Produce. I had an apple tree full of Anna apples. I don't know if you remember this.
I do.
And I called you, and I don't even know why I called you, but I had, 200 pounds of apples. And you told me, just get them picked and share with me how many pounds you got. And literally, they were sold within 24 hours. And somebody came by and picked them up, and I assume they went to a great restaurant or a food purveyor. But it can be that simple to interact with you, right?
Yes. Yeah, that was a gift. Anna apples are a lovely gift in the middle of summer in the desert. And yes, we work with folks two rows at spaces of opportunity to 40 acres or more. And as with a farmer's market, when you have a new vendor and the labels get on crooked, and there's a learning curve for all of us of how to interact and what the public wants. And yes, I want to be a farmer. How do I know what to grow? How do I know how to price it? How do I know how to package it? And so we, which means co-op staff as well as other farms, provide support to help folks grow. What the median age in Arizona for farmers is 63 or 64 years old. And so where is the next generation of farming going to come from?
Yeah.
Where is the food going to come from? Does Phoenix in particular, but anywhere in the state, really not want to have open space, really not want to have farms, really not want to distinguish themselves from esteemed places that grow food in the Midwest by not having their own flavor profile, not having things that only grow in the desert? Another aspect of safe food systems, we have to keep the land safe to farm.
Yeah. And so my farm in Phoenix was a third of an acre. And when I went back to college and I think this is around maybe when you and I met, when I went back to college in the late 90s, I was farming my front and backyard. And I was growing I'd make a couple $100 a week going to the farmer's market, sharing what I had grown in my front yard. Because so it can literally be that simple, right?
Yes. Yes. That's how I met Maya Daly from Maya's farm. She started out exactly growing in her front yard and selling to chefs. And yes, it's what you accomplish there at the urban farm in the middle of a neighborhood with not only fertile soil, but a fertile mind and an understanding that it doesn't have to look like a 2,000 acre tract.
Yeah.
But just, put something in and see what happens.
Yeah. And this would be a perfect thing. I've said this for years. It'd be a perfect thing for a high school student, for a stay-at-home parent, for people that are retired. Because literally, I would work a day a week, start early on Wednesday morning. I'd harvest my stuff. I'd take it to the Wednesday midday market.
Yeah.
I'd make my $200 or $300. And anything I had left over, I took and shared with Susan at the Calico Cow, and she fed me lunch.
Yeah.
So I just gave her what I had left over and she'd make me lunch. And it's a great community building process. And we're laughing about this. This is just, so that's what it can do. And that's how easy it can be.
Yeah, exactly. And she was that place. She was proud to serve the hands on. She knew you, she knew what it took to get that food. when we, my husband and I, sit down to dinner, we say, "Oh, I know who grew that food." We try to grow a lot of our own now and have for a bunch of years, but every night we, "Oh, that's from Maya. Oh, that's from Blue Sky. All that Jana, all that kind of thing." And they're real people. And it's not easy, even if you do it one day a week. It's hard work.
It's a process. Yeah, that's
It's a
for sure.
process, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So you mentioned the word food hub. What does that mean?
Loosely, I believe that it means the connection between the farmer and the consumer. And it also includes them, but there's always this idea of, here are the people that produce the food. Here are the people that want to eat it. How do we get the
Connect them.
food from one place to another?
Yeah.
Think of the hub as in the middle of with the spokes going out.
Got it.
So we basically run trucks, Greg. It's not as glamorous as you could possibly imagine, but it's quite got its thing. So it's cachet. And so we, some food hubs work by having the farms delivered to them and then they go out and bring things to customers. We don't have that set up yet, and we could drive all the way from Agritopia Farm in Gilbert all the way to the west side in back and hit farms in between in one day. And so asking, many of the farms that we get food from don't have their own trucks. They don't have their own refrigerated trucks. So what we've been working on is leveraging resources so that they can stay on the farm, do what they do best, which is grow food. And we help them sell more of it.
Nice. You just facilitate the food moving process. Awesome. Awesome. Sun Produce. And how do you feel like it's going? Is there, actually, let me ask you this. I always like to look for epic. And for me, epic is that moment when something happens and you say to yourself, oh my gosh, wow, this is the reason that I'm doing what I'm doing.
Thank you for asking that. The epic moment came for me about 4:30 one summer morning. I was working for the Food Bank Association and I was at Duncan Family Farms. And he is a producer that not only donates about 1 million pounds of food every year from his farm, but he grows extra to make sure that the food banks have it.
Wow.
And my job was to gather food for people who didn't have enough to eat. And I said, "Thank you, Arnett, for what you're doing." And he said to me, "Don't thank me. I'm not making enough." This was many years ago and it's no longer true, but he said, "I don't make enough to take the tax credit for the donation." And
Wow.
all of a sudden, the sun's coming up, and I'm like, "Wait a second. There's all this food, there's all these hungry people, and you, as a farmer, aren't making enough money to make a living."
Yeah.
And of course, through their own hard work, they have changed that situation for themselves. But I will have to tell you that I don't know that this statistics for the number of people who are hungry have gone down, not because of the heroic efforts of the food banks who work to serve millions and millions of families with food, but because, and this is for a whole nother conversation, the things that lead to people going hungry aren't a lack of food. They are not enough
Yes.
money, too high rents, no transportation, no help, all the things that you can get in trouble for if you don't take care of, like paying your light bill or going to work or whatever, okay, the food comes last. And so you pay for what you can get. And so that's a whole nother systems conversation for another day, but it's completely related to how do we have local agriculture contribute as an economic generator for the community. And even in the face of expanding development, how do these farms, if, for instance, schools who spend $350 million a year on food for their students committed to buying 5% of that amount from local farms, what a difference that would make in the tax base, in the resources for the schools.
Yeah.
All of that kind of thing. And so again, it's the food is the reason for thinking about this, but the ripple effect of buying local is a whole nother subject.
It's huge. Yeah. Yeah.
So that was my aha moment.
Nice, nice. Well, thank you for doing all that you do. I, like I said, we've known each other for at least two, maybe 2.5 decades. And we paralleled each other in a lot of things when we were in Phoenix. And it's amazing what you've done. Thank you.
Right back at you, Greg. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's part of who you are.
So I'm going to shift on you, and I'd like for you to talk about a time you failed, how you overcame that failure, and what you learned from it.
I failed in bringing the Phoenix Public Market to fruition. I had a board of directors that went in a different direction than I did.
Uh-huh.
And they chose to go in that direction, perhaps without including me in the planning process. And I did not fight them. I was shocked that somebody could do that. And I get why and what and all of that, although it took me about 6 years to figure all that out.
Mm-hmm.
But the takeaway was, if there's something that you really care about, fight and fight hard. And don't let anybody, and I'm not that person. I don't like conflict. I feel like things work themselves out, whatever's meant to be. I don't feel like that completely anymore. And in holding on to this co-op, which has had its ups and downs financially over the past 7 years, I've had to employ that in that experience and say, oh, should I just let it go? It's not up to me,
yeah.
But should we just let it go? Or if this is something that is making a difference, what do we need to do differently? And who do we need to be working with and talking to? So that it was formative, even though I was way past being a grown-up at the time. Yeah,
wow.
That was it.
And what do you consider your biggest success?
Well, I have my son and his family, who I think he's amazing. It's not because of me, it's because of who he is, but I consider that a success. I went back to college after 17 years of goofing around and got a degree. And
really?
That was...
This I didn't know about you, because I went back to college after 19 years and got a degree.
Oh, I didn't know that about you either. It was expected of me to go to college, but I didn't. When I went, it was Vietnam War area. I had a lot of work to do in the community, so to speak. And when I went back, I was super focused on.
Yep.
So same for you.
Yeah. Yeah. My first time in college was 1981, and I spent a semester at Arizona State University and got a 0.5 grade average. I got two D's and an F, and my dad looked at me and he says, oh, you don't want to be in college? And I said, no, but I never stopped going to college. I always went to Phoenix College and took classes on solar energy or wastewater management. Anytime I was interested in something in the time in between, I ended up back at Arizona State University in 1999. And that time I got a 4.0 and a 3.97 in my master's degree. I was really into it the second time.
you were ready then, and it makes a difference because it's not, that whole process isn't that easy. But when you go back as an adult, sometimes you don't have to do all the side stuff that is going on around you. And I'll say the third thing was that when I started working with the Food Bank Association, I had the privilege of working with Ginny Hildebrand and Penny Braun. And our conversation began to include words like ending hunger, not just addressing the 3 to 5 days, not only addressing the 3 to 5, but finding out the systems approach to why people are hungry and food access. And I will feel like I got to participate in and be part of changing the linguistics of food and food security over 25, 35 years. And I am grateful for that. I feel like it's not everybody that gets it, and it's not only what's needed, but be talking about and acting on addressing what it's like to get enough food, again, is got to do more than food. It's a bigger social issue.
A bigger conversation.
Yeah. So I feel like those are the three things that keep me going.
Awesome. And what drives you?
Hard to say. I feel like I'm the same person that I was when I was 12 years old, except my knees don't work so well. And it's the same things that were instilled in me, to be fair. And that's always been a value, like when you see that things aren't fair, to try to even that out. Family, art, all sorts of things, gardening, all sorts of things. But I think that fairness issue will see me lose my cool more than anything else.
And if you could recommend one book for our listeners, what would it be and why?
I read a lot, and I read mysteries and all sorts of things, but I just finished a book by Diane Wilson called The Seed Keeper. And it talked about the writer's experience and her grandmother's and great-grandmother's experience being driven from their land and their ways of life as Native Americans. But it focused on a cache of seeds that a great-grandmother had buried in a certain place. And the young woman circled back in her life to try to find those seeds, and found herself learning about seed saving.
Oh, and nice.
I have been a dilettante about seed saving. I do it, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm. But that book got me super interested. She went in very good detail about how she saves tomato seeds, for instance, which I did not do last year. And some of my tomato seeds are working and some of them aren't. But it made me think, stop and pay attention, because each seed needs something different. And if you want to keep its life going, then you need to learn how to take care of it while it's resting and while it can grow. And so I plan to do more of that. And of course, there was always in the background, the story of her, how she got to be where she was and what happened to her family.
Nice.
I recommend it. Yeah.
It's called The Seed Keeper.
Mm-hmm. Diane Wilson.
Awesome. Thank you. And what one final piece of advice do you have for our listeners?
I have three, Greg, and thank you. One is, pay attention to what nourishes you. Strive for excellence, beauty, fairness, but cut yourself some slack sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And don't think you know what the other person is thinking or why they're thinking it.
Oh my gosh, that is an invaluable piece of advice. Wow, thank you so much for joining us on the show today, Cindy.
Thank you, Greg. It's been a long time coming, and I have very much enjoyed talking with you as we prepared for this and just getting to know you a little better and a little differently.
Yeah, right back at you. And how can our listeners get a hold of Sun Produce?
We have a website amazingly called sunproducecoop.org, S-U-N, produce, COOP.org. And my email is sunproducecoop@gmail.com. And I'm pretty good at answering.
Awesome. You can find show notes from today's podcast at urbanfarm.org/sunproduce.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Urban Farm Podcast. Remember to listen for tips, advice, and resources to help you on your journey with urban farming. You can find us on the web at urbanfarm.org or send us an email to podcast@urbanfarm.org. In the words of Vincent Van Gogh, great things are done by a series of small things brought together. Be encouraged that with each lesson learned and skill developed, you are one step closer in the direction of your dreams.